Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Cavanaugh Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down at the Roundtable.
Back to our discussion of structure, we're still talking about Gone with the Wind. We got a lot of structure to talk about with Gone with the Wind. We were discussing Scarlet, so Sarah E., pick up with Scarlet.
I also think looking at her as everyone in that time period was, you know, she's a victim of trauma and how that those hardships both forced her to grow up too soon, but also stunt her development.
And you can see every one of those happen on the page. Margaret Mitchell gives us Scarlett's thoughts and her reactions and her thought process as she endures and survives everything she goes through. And as she watches her friends and family and the people she doesn't like go through things, she thinks about how they go through them. We see her think about those people's lives and struggles as well. And it's, you don't get that in the movie. You don't get all that in Scarlett's head from the movie. You don't get her thinking about all these other characters and you know, being angry that they react this way when why don't they feel the way she feels? She really doesn't understand. She thinks she's right, you know, to feel the way she feels a lot of the time. And she doesn't understand why, for example, after the war, are all these friends of hers, the Wilkeses, the Hamiltons, all the people in Atlanta that are in her social circle, they're all just poverty stricken now. The war has destroyed the plantation culture. All the former wealthy people are not wealthy anymore. And they're proud of their poverty. As I think Scarlett says, it's something like they wear it like a badge or something. And she wants to earn money. She wants to be successful. She believes money is the only thing that can protect her and her loved ones from absolute destruction. And she doesn't understand why all those other people don't feel the same way. She really doesn't. And it's that there's a really great passage before she decides to set her sights on Frank Kennedy and marry him. In the movie, it's so funny because she goes right out of the horse jail where she tried to get Rhett to give her money for Tara, and it right immediately in the movie, the next moment she runs into Frank Kennedy, and we know she set her sights on him. She's gonna marry him. The book, it's not that fast. There's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on that, you know, her little mind is working, and she sees all these other people accept poverty, and they're proud to be poor and all that stuff, and she doesn't get it, and she doesn't get it, and she doesn't get it. And then she meets up again with Frank, and she's like, oh, he's got, you know, a pretty successful business. I'm, you know, that's my ticket, you know. So anyway, I digressed. But
that's actually a great segue. I don't want to interrupt you, though.
Please. Go ahead.
It's a beautiful segue into Scarlett's lack of self-awareness and how, structure-wise, yes, we were in her point of view a lot, but I'm so grateful for the author allowing us to drop into other people's point of view.
Yes.
I enjoyed the brief amounts that were in her first and second husband's head, because you realize, you know, the relationship they think they're getting is not the relationship they're gonna get.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I love being in Melanie's head too, because while Melanie has a much higher level of emotional intelligence than Scarlett does, she still dupes herself constantly because she just can't admit that most people, that in everyone they're going to have moments that they're not their best selves.
Yeah.
And she does begin to see that in some characters, but she never sees it in Scarlett. She's utterly blind to Scarlett having the amount of flaws and bad motivations that she does.
Yes. Go ahead.
I enjoyed being in her head, because I think we would have missed kind of that tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
if we weren't in Melanie's head.
Yeah, she is absolutely blind. Melanie is absolutely blind to any negative anything in the people she loves. And Rhett says that about her to Scarlett. Again, Margaret Mitchell gives us an analysis of Melanie's character through Rhett's voice, which I find fascinating. At the same time, in the book, it's very subtle, and you have to really look for it. But Melanie, you know, she is one of the characters who is still kind of stuck in the past, longing for the past in certain ways. Unlike Scarlett, who is willing to let go of that and move forward, you know, Melanie, I don't want to say she's more racist, because that's not what I mean, but part of the past is slave culture, is plantation culture, which meant slave ownership. And it's all well and good for Ashley to say that, you know, even if the war hadn't come, his family would have freed their slaves. Melanie's family doesn't say that. They're cousins, but her side of the family, she never says that. Now, had she married Ashley and no war had come, she, as a woman, would have obviously gone along with whatever her husband decided, because that's how life was for women back in the day. They had no, you know, they weren't supposed to have any say in how men ran the plantations or whatever, or any businesses for that matter. So we have to accept that although Melanie is portrayed, you know, in popular culture and in the book, she is truly the personification of the good, you know, Southern woman. And she definitely sees everyone she loves through the rose-colored glasses of love. She's not an unflawed character. You know, she represents a certain genteel Southern lady that Margaret Mitchell grew up knowing women like that, okay? And so, you know, I feel like that's, as much as I love Miss Melly, you know, I gotta say that about her. You know, she's not perfect, you know?
No, I mean, she has no issues with all the men in town, including her husband, being members of the KKK.
Right. And she also has no problem with Belle Watling, the prostitute. She thinks the best of her. She's a white woman, right? Belle Watling's a white woman. You know, she really tries or firmly sees or believes that, you know, there's goodness in people in spite of their circumstances. So Melanie is flawed, but she also has that definite kind of nobility of character to try to see the best in everybody. And, you know, the best example of that is her evaluation of Rhett. Rhett Butler, when Melanie meets him at Ashley and the Wilkes' barbecue, when he bursts on the scene in All Our Lives, right? He's definitely a bad boy, a Civil War era bad boy at that time. He's not received, I'm doing that in air quotes again, which means that good families are not supposed to let him in their homes around their virginal daughters or whatever. You know, he's not received by polite society. And, you know, but she, Melanie, sees him as a noble, good, kind man, mostly because she sees how much he loves Scarlett, but also because he comes to their rescue several times in many disastrous situations. And, you know, in her worldview, she knows he's not doing that for Melanie herself. He's doing that because he loves Scarlett. He shows up and helps or does things, you know, for Scarlett. And so in Melanie's mind, true love trumps everything, right? It eclipses any bad behavior that Rhett Butler might have. He really loves Scarlett. Scarlett loves Melanie as a sister. Rhett loves Scarlett. Therefore, Rhett is good. That's Melanie's thought process. You know, it's pretty simple that way. The most amazing thing about Melanie, I think, in terms of how we see other characters through her eyes, is that when we first meet Melanie at the 12 Oaks barbecue at the beginning of the book, and she defends Scarlett to the jealous girls, this is amazing to me, because she doesn't really know Scarlett that well yet. She just sort of knows her a little bit. You know, they've seen each other win. You know, it wasn't like today's world where, I mean, Atlanta and where Clay County, where Tara and the Wilkes' plantation, 12 Oaks, they're not close to each other. I mean, this was travel, okay? They did. So they couldn't have seen each other very often in their 16 and 17 years of life, right? But she sees Scarlett as if she's looking at Scarlett through an almost wistful lens. Scarlett is high-spirited. She's vivacious, and she's physically beautiful. All of these things are, you know, Melanie sees these things in Scarlett as not being in Scarlett's control or intent. It's just who she is. She can't help it if she's that attractive. And Melanie accepts that about Scarlett from the get-go, that she sees Scarlett almost wistfully. You almost feel like Melanie wishes she could be a little more like Scarlett in all those ways, physically beautiful, vivacious and comfortable around the boys, the men, high-spirited, all that. You almost feel like she just, not jealously, but wistfully,
right, yeah, she's not,
you know,
jealous.
Just mm-hmm. wistfully, like she admires her for right. these characteristics that she doesn't even think Scarlett can control. They're just part of who she is. Mm-hmm. So, and she doesn't ever see her as just like a spoiled brat kind of a thing.
I kind of see Melanie as a lot like Jane Bennett in Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
I think it physically hurts both of those characters to think ill of somebody else.
Yeah.
I think it just stresses them out so much that they have to, in their heads, rewrite it so that everybody can be good.
Well, and although Melanie doesn't talk a lot about being a good Christian Southern woman, you know, it would be unchristian of her. You know, in that day and age, the phrase unchristian, it would have been unchristian of her to see Scarlett in anything other than this positive light, especially for things that Melanie feels Scarlett can't help. She can't help be beautiful. She can't help be vivacious. She can't help be high-spirited. All those things are not Scarlett's fault, in other words. And it's so interesting to me that we see Scarlett through those eyes early on in the book. even after Scarlett marries Melanie's brother Charles, basically out of spite, because Melanie's marrying Ashley and Scarlett's all upset about that because she thinks she's in love with Ashley and all that. And Melanie's reaction is, now we're really and truly sisters. I mean, she's happy. You know, she does not see that Scarlett married her brother for all the wrong reasons, you know. It's just, she really means that. From that moment on, Scarlett is her sister. And it's quite amazing. She forever sees her through this, Melanie sees Scarlett through this habitual, kind, and loving lens. And there is nothing Scarlett ever does that changes Melanie's love for her. And nothing ever changes Melanie's belief that Scarlett is strong and capable and good. That is a remarkable character written by Margaret Mitchell, you know. You had mentioned Charles and Frank, and in our notes you said you felt like they'd been duped into marrying Scarlett. And yes, they were duped. They were duped. But I also think they never saw Scarlett as much more than an object to possess, a sex object to possess.
Absolutely.
And again, I'm going to remind us and everybody else about the age differences between Scarlett and these men that she marries. Charles is older than Scarlett by 10 or so years. He's very naive, though. He's not worldly like, oh gosh, Rhett or God, even Ashley. He's very naive. He equates her physical beauty with ladylike perfection. That's part of his naivete, that he thinks that just her physical beauty means that she's the perfect lady, okay? But, you know, it's clear that he has a physical attraction to her. He can't even, like, speak clearly when he's around her. He just gets all flustered and everything. And with Frank, I mean, Frank Kennedy, Scarlett's second husband, you know, he was engaged to her sister, Sue Ellen, for years, and he betrays years of engagement to, you know, marry Scarlett, and that only happens because he's physically attracted to Scarlett, and he kind of gets manipulated by her, but he lets that happen. He's in his 30s, if not 40s. He's way older than Scarlett at this point. By now, she's maybe 17, 18 years old, right? I don't even know if she's 18. 19, maybe. I mean, she's still pretty young. My point is that both of these men that she marries, which, by the way, she doesn't have children in the movie with these men, but she does in the book with both of them. But both of these men do not see her intelligence or her strength as positives. Quite the opposite. Even if they see those characteristics, they want to quash them. And they want Scarlett to kind of, you know, get back and get molded into this good little Southern gentlewoman wifey mold, if you will. It's hard for me to feel sorry for them because of that, because they kind of got what they wanted, air quotes again, which is sex, you know, husband's sexual rights over her physically attractive body. I don't feel all that sorry for them. That said,
I don't feel all that sorry for them.
I did kind of feel a little bit of sympathy for Charles when during the Margaret Mitchell does a really good job of writing the scene of the description of Scarlett and Charles's wedding night, because she reminds us in the way she writes that, which has both their perspectives, both their point of view is clear in that chapter. She reminds us just how naive and how young they really are. Scarlett's 16. She's terrified when she realizes the reality of the marriage bed and what she's done to herself by marrying Charles and what she's going to have to do. And, you know, 2 weeks later, Charles goes off to war. 5 weeks after that, he's dead from the measles followed by pneumonia. And she's pregnant with her first child. So, you know, we know that at some point in the first 2 weeks of their marriage before he went off to war, they had sex, and it wasn't their wedding night, because Margaret Mitchell does a great job of, you know, describing to us how Scarlett's like, if you come near me, I'm going to kill you, and he goes away, you know. And, you know, so that I had a little bit of sympathy for him in that, because, like you said, his expectation of what, you know, who he was marrying and what that meant and to what marriage would be like, nothing to do with the reality of marrying Scarlett O'Hara, right? I think that was a very good thing you said. And, you know, as far as Frank and Scarlett's marriage, I don't really feel sorry for him at all. She has, in effect, sold her body to him. I mean, it's pretty much, from her point of view, she's marrying him because of his money. I mean, we get her point of view, her thoughts, kind of convincing herself that she's fond of him, he's all right, you know, whatever. But the bottom line is, she doesn't love him, she doesn't have any physical attraction for him, or anything other than she needs that money. She wants to have, be part of his future business opportunities as well. She can see that play out in the future. And, you know, so it's a bargain in her mind, like a business bargain. He gets to have sex with her, and she gets financial security for herself and her loved ones. And loved ones, I mean, all of them, the ones in Atlanta, the ones at Tara, and they have a child too. So, you know, we don't see those two children much in the movie, I think. I don't think Ella's not in the movie at all. I think Charles and Scarlett's little boy Wade might be in the movie, but Ella's not in the movie. I can't even remember. It's been so long since I watched the movie. I don't know.
Regarding feeling sorry for the husbands, I would say I feel like 15% sorry, and the rest of it honestly is just amusement at how different what is going on in their heads is to what's going on in Scarlett's head.
I
found, and I think Mitchell, in the way she writes it, I think she finds it kind of funny too.
I think she did. And the more you know about Margaret Mitchell's personal life and the kind of woman that she was, because she was very flirtatious, she was very as Melanie would say, vivacious and high-spirited and all that, she had a lot of interesting, you know, adult, you know, she was not the norm for the Southern gentlewoman, even in her adulthood would have been, I would say the 30s, I think, because she died in 1948, I think. And, yes, and, or no, she was 48 when she died. Now I can't remember when she, anyway, but she, you know, she was young at a time when, you know, you were still supposed to be kind of, you know, not too flirty with men, shall we say. And so I think she probably had a lot of funny, if you will, experiences with just either observing or being in situations where men's thoughts and you know, how, what they expected women to behave or not behave in certain ways and everything probably was pretty funny to her. This has been At the Roundtable with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org.
This activity made possible in part with support from the Indiana Arts Commission and the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.